content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading selections from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. So the March issue of Our State magazine has been featuring articles all about spring cleaning. So in this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into that issue and learn some more about spring cleaning in the state of North Carolina. Our first article is entitled Breathing Room. At a Rockingham County Retreat Center, stillness opens the door for clarity and renewal. The author of this article first visited St. Francis Springs with Cappy Kirsch's School of Healing Presence. The center also hosts an array of themed and silent retreats, most of which utilize the stunning San Damiano Chapel. And there's a picture of it here. It's a canopy of green from all of the trees. There's a cobblestone path leading to the chapel, and the chapel is mostly glass, with some touches of brick around it and an A-line roof with a high peak, and in the front of the roof area is all glass. I always listen for the pileated woodpecker as I walk the winding trails at St. Francis Springs Prayer Center in Stoneville. I return to this place often as I grapple with embracing the crone that I am and seek to understand this season of life. My home, an old cabin in Germantown, sits unhurried now after years of holding a house full of children and the energy their activities entailed. My husband retired, and so I did too, from the part-time job I'd held for several years. I looked in the mirror and realized what I thought were sun-kissed highlights in my hair were actually threads of gray from 6 decades of living. My mind sang, "Are you running out of time?" Snippets from the musical Hamilton. And I wondered, so what do I do now? Probing this answer is what brought me to St. Francis Springs, a 155-acre wooded retreat in Rockingham County that's welcomed thousands of guests each year for day trips and retreats. Here, the resonating message is that I don't have to do anything. Rather, the space urges, just be. Trees whisper with movement and join their branches in an arch above me. A stump flicks its ears, and I realize it's really a docile deer resting in a mottled light. We watch each other patiently as a crow calls and a dainty white butterfly dances over the creek. It's clear I'm in a sacred space. On this particular visit, I've come to St. Francis Springs for an overnight stay, alone. The rich smell of leaf decay reminds me of my childhood, and I follow the creek, miss my turn, talk to a turtle, and admire petite red chanterelles squeezing through leaf mulch. A red-shouldered hawk calls, and while I inadvertently walk the stations of the cross in reverse, the messages of peace still resonate no matter where I start. A bulbous bacterial crown gall shows me that imperfection can be beautiful. Its mission of hospitality, justice, and contemplation permeates the prayer center. Before the lodge kneels a statue of St. Francis embracing the leper, a reminder to care for the vulnerable. Guests can stay in the cherry-paneled lodge, group cottages, or single hermitages. There are spaces for gatherings and nooks for quiet contemplation. Volunteers assist with cleaning rooms, cooking meals, washing dishes, cutting grass, mailing letters, building carpenter bee catchers, and more. Meanwhile, the friar in residence, Friar Bob Menard, OFM, offers daily prayer times, Sunday Mass, and spiritual direction for those who seek it. He also washes dishes several times a week. At mealtimes, some enjoy fellowship in the dining room, but I prefer to sit alone outside, watching a wren fly back and forth as she feeds her brood. Afterward, I visit the bookstore and its vast selection from diverse authors, browsing topics like justice and peace. prayer and contemplation, creativity, gender and sexuality, grief, environmental studies, and more. Nearby, the Library of the Disinherited holds about 2,000 books by African American, Native American, and women authors, and includes a banned book section. Intentionality permeates this place, even down to the bamboo toilet paper. I'm grateful Friar Louis Canino, OFM, whom everyone knows as Father Louis, didn't give up when he first felt called to create an interfaith contemplative prayer center while serving in Pennsylvania in the early 1980s. He waited to implement his vision as he spent 3 years in Boston as rector of a massive urban ministry center with a breakneck schedule. Each year when he took his required week-long retreat, Father Louis almost always chose to spend his time in silence. "I really believe God speaks to us profoundly through silence," he says, calling the practice transformational. In 1989, Father Louis received a sabbatical to study spirituality in Pittsburgh. He proposed his idea of a prayer center again, but his superior asked him to relocate to North Carolina to lead the Franciscan Center, a new storefront ministry in downtown Greensboro. "Even though I didn't want to do this, I came," Father Louis says as he recalls honoring his vow of obedience. The desire for a prayer center continued to tug, and fortunately, the move to Greensboro connected him to a network of helpers. "God used me, but it's really God's idea," he says. In 1998, Father Louis proposed the concept once more, and this time received a green light. Along with a steering committee, he sought land near Greensboro that would be far enough for guests to feel away from their daily responsibilities, but close enough not to preclude taking time away. The site in Stoneville has trails and streams and an 80-foot elevation change. The land embodies St. Francis of Assisi's connection to nature and commitment to contemplation. "We believe nature reveals to us the beauty of God, and God speaks to us in nature," Father Louis says. "I wanted to have a haven where we could get together to praise our God and also realize we are all connected. Back outdoors, I try to tread silently, stepping over damp tulip poplar petals atop the gravel path as I spot wordless life lessons everywhere. Seedlings sprout from decaying stumps, while toppled trees nourish yellow patches and artists bracket fungi. I walk the labyrinth, though I'm not sure I'm doing it right, then remember imperfection is inescapable. The San Damiano Chapel provides respite from a loud world that calls for action as I'm surrounded by wall-sized windows framing nature up close. This morning, no one is here but me." Some people want a deeply contemplative experience, says St. Francis Springs director Steve Swain, who first came here for retreat in 2012. "Others want rest. Others want to heal." Since its inception, the Prayer Center has welcomed guests from more than 40 states and 9 countries, each on a different path in their spiritual journeys. About one-third of the guests seek solace as individuals. "I hope that silence will speak to them of what they need to be in their life," Father Louis says. Though it sounds simple, for me, finding silence takes intention and commitment and practice. It's why I return here again and again, seeking and receiving this profound connection to the divine. Swain says that the silence offered at the prayer center provides time to listen to God and to yourself, to practically understand how to live this life. In our society, sometimes people ask, "What do you do?" Not, "Who are you?" Not, "What do you want to be?" he says. This place asks, "Who do you want to be?" And that can be incredibly jarring. You've got to be still so you can really start to understand who you are. That's what this place is. It offers the opportunity for people to become. "I'm only 40 minutes from home when I venture to this sacred place, and yet I feel a world away from the chores of my daily life. Bolder faces watch me loop through the woods yet again. I move a wet worm off a dry path and listen to the water tumble in the celestial waterfall garden. 25 years ago, on a cold Sunday morning in April, before the prayer center began serving guests, Father Louis led a Eucharistic celebration with the steering committee at an aged rock formation now named Carceri Grotto. Resurrection fern finds a foothold here in every crevice that has actually ever captured decayed debris, a living lesson in resilience and rebirth. It's so quiet here, with so much to hear. For more information, visit stfrancis.today. That's S-T, F as in Frank, R-A-N-C-I-S, .today. The next article is from a series of three essays on letting go and holding on. It's entitled A Clean Sweep, is the section. This one is Confessions of a Pack Rat. In the sandy shells, worn ticket stubs, and chipped mugs he can't seem to part with, a sentimental saver finds a map to memories and meaning. "Does this bring you joy?" my wife Megan asks. She's holding up a dusty glass beer mug filled with a melange of rocks, shells, and pocket change, a strand of green Mardi Gras beads draped over the embossed image of the wrestler Andre the Giant, his chest bare, arms akimbo. She half waits for an answer, but she knows without a doubt what's coming. From anyone else, this query would be something of a decluttering litmus test. Does this thing elicit some level of elevation? If not, why keep it? But from Megan, who's elbow deep in a box filled with a lifetime of my junk, or rather my memories, it's more of an inside joke. She knows my penchant for accumulating keepsakes and mementos, my love, or more accurately, my need to collect things. She has no way of knowing what she's holding. The origins of the mug, a novelty I bought as a teenager in 1985 from Spencer Gifts in the mall. Who Andre Giant is, the greatest wrestler ever to live, a hill I will die on. Who just so happens to make his home in Ellerby, only 50 miles south of our home in Ashboro. Or what's in it? Stones picked up decades ago on hikes through the Uari Mountains after we moved to North Carolina. Scotch bonnets collected on walks along the Outer Banks months after our daughter was born. Vestiges of tips earned when I delivered pizza in college. But I can tell that my wife is at least aware of the significance of what she has in her hands. Well, it's significance to me. There's no need to inspect the mug's contents. Same for the cigar box brimming with my late father's long-ago broken pocket knives and ticket stubs from every concert I've ever attended. The crocodile skin jewelry box in which my late mother kept her pricelessly worthless costume jewelry and where I now stash my most prized football and basketball cards. The velvet bag bulging with bundles of thank you notes, birthday cards, and even postcards from the 1940s and 50s shared between my dad and his brother when the latter was in the Air Force. I know what's hidden inside. I know the amount of joy each squirreled away artifact holds for me. And she knows the answer. Yes, that brings me joy. The trouble with being a transplant is that when you move somewhere new, you usually have every intention of traveling light. When I moved here 20 years ago, all my belongings fit into the bed of my pickup. But before I knew it, I'd started collecting a life, bit by bit, souvenir by souvenir. There's the chipped mug I've held onto from the Atlantis Lodge in Salter Path, the Grandfather Mountain t-shirt I bought after getting caught in a downpour, a Pepsi Cola crate rescued from one of the huge antique shops on Sunset Avenue in Ashboro. Each precious thing has a story, and each story feels like a living root, proof I belonged somewhere. I acquired that Pepsi crate one Saturday last spring when I just wandered into Collector's Antiques Mall to take a look. The place smelled of old wood and brass polish, every booth a tiny museum of someone else's memories. I moved slowly through the aisles of milk glass and mason jars, past a row of rotary phones and stacks of white and green Pyrex bowls, the kind that sat in nearly every kitchen in the 1970s. Then I saw a toy that stirred me stirred in me a joy I'd thought long buried, a small blue and red Hot Wheels replica of the King's STP stock car. Just like the model I'd raced across the linoleum floor of my grandmother's parent kitchen 50 years before. I picked it up, and suddenly I was 6 years old again. Of course, I bought this reminder of a forgotten memory. Somewhere along the way, I stopped pretending I was collecting beer mugs, Kentucky Derby pins, ticket stubs, and started curating. Now my shelves look less like chaos and more like a museum. Artifacts of a misspent youth, the great candle era, phone charges of the lost generation, books. So many books. How does an English major part with his Norton Anthology of Literature? Dog-eared copies of Romeo and Juliet and Death of a Salesman, and all those Cliff's Notes. And then there are the bins labeled with my daughter's name, age, and corresponding grade, filled with every macaroni art project, every painted rock, every progress report, and every spelling test in English and en español. I tell myself I'm saving them for her, but I know better. I'm saving them for me. Proof that something's growing here. Proof that, even as a transplant, I've taken root. Sometimes I wonder if she'll be a sentimental saver like her father and grandparents. Maybe she's learning from me that keeping things isn't just about memory. It's about meaning. It's how we say, this mattered. Maybe that's what all this stuff is really, really is. Evidence of a life lived, not always neatly, but fully. The chipped mugs, the faded T-shirts, the macaroni masterpieces, they're markers of time, of love, of belonging. I used to think clutter was proof of chaos. Now I see it as a map, a trail of breadcrumbs leading back to every place I've been lucky enough to call home. Someday when my daughter goes through these boxes and bins, she'll probably roll her eyes and maybe, hopefully, squirrel away one or two things for herself. Her grandmother's gnarled leather baby shoe, my first lock blade engraved with my initials that I ordered from an ad and TV guide, a shell from the beach where she took her first steps on sand. Maybe she'll understand that being a pack rat isn't about holding on to things. It's about holding on to who we are, of who we were, and how we got here. Holding on to joy. The second essay in this sub-series, if you will, is entitled Porch Perfect. March in North Carolina is a fickle thing, but a writer in Greensboro takes advantage of the first warm days to scrub his porch and roll out the red carpet for spring. We're not big spring cleaning people, to be honest. With two dogs and two boys, we probably should be, but it's those same dogs and boys who usually leave us running too ragged to do much of anything besides kick the fur / cereal under the couch and move along. Our cleaning bursts tend to arrive from abject necessity. A snowstorm. Spilled milk. We cry, reader. Dog versus rug. Dog versus backyard. Rather than wondering what to do with a Saturday that yawns open before us. Our Saturdays rarely yawn. On that first warm Saturday, though, which by rule cannot come in January or February, any scattered 70-degree days, there are anomalies. We go digging for the ratty swimsuits, make a bucket of dish soap, and head out onto the porch to scrub away a season's worth of grime. Where are we? A double-digit day in March, probably. Some stuff has bloomed, but not all. The 10-day forecast says it's certainly too soon to put the firewood caddy back down in the basement. But on this day, it's warm, truly warm, and meals need to be eaten outside. Books read on the silly outdoor sofa, probably more suited to complementing an above-ground pool. Rugs hosed off. Hey, look how clean that came in the driveway. It's slow work, but that's fine. Spring training on the radio, the boys helping out, the moment when it all turns into a water fight not so far away. Just like regular dawn, like they use for birds in oil spills, diluted and scrubbed on and hosed back off. Was it last year the boys were old enough to do the ladder work on their own? Is this the year we actually hang a ceiling fan out there? pre-second rescue dog, we lived out there, so this must, then, be the year we actually trained this untrainable beast. She does not even turn her head when you call her name to sit out there with us. We wash the rocking chairs and the sofa frame and brush the last dead leaves out of the corners of the cushions. We hang the lights back up, bistro bulbs that replaced a strand of 300 white wedding lights my buddy dropped off 1 year ago with a note. The boys will figure out what to do with these. We hung them during the height of the pandemic, and they have been porch light people most seasons ever since. We need those lights late into the long summer nights, but we need them more now in spring, when evening still comes on relatively early. North Carolina weather seems to be purpose-built to break your heart. Our shoulder seasons swing so unpredictably back and forth that I warn my not from here first-year college students about it. My own boys now know that we'll almost always lose that first truly cool fall week to a tropical system. They know, too, that we've pushed it a couple of times and had a fire in the fireplace as late as Memorial Day. March, for its part, always sucker punches. The dogwoods bloom or the saucer magnolias, and then there's the week that there's 47 degrees and rain. But this is not that week, not yet. This is the day that conjures those blooms in the first place, a day filled with promise and hope and nasty, filthy rags that the boys are now chasing each other around with. Some friend comes by on a bike and off the kids go, and now it's just my wife and me left to put everything back in its place, the rocking chairs just so, and the plant stands, if not the plants. The lights are strung evenly enough for tonight, and that decision about the ceiling fan, well, it can wait. It's not perfect, this first warm Saturday cleaning, and it needn't be. The pollen is yet to come, as are several storms that may find our outdoor items unsecured. We're looking for a clean enough, a sofa you're happy to sit on, a table upon which you'd happily rest a glass. Maybe our muscles are a little sore, but it's of the happy sort. A decent day's work done, and unlike so many kinds of work, an easy, obvious result. We'll sit out here and wait for the boys to come home. We won't go in until it's fully dark. Even then, we'll pull together something simple for dinner, leash up the bad dog and the good dog, and come back out to sit in the lights of a mostly clean porch on a night that's lying to us in the best way about what weather's yet to come. This next article is entitled A Host of Golden Daffodils. Bursting forth with heads held high, these heralds of spring are welcome sights across our state. Linville Gorge daffodil flats, yellow daffodils, said to be from long-gone 1800s homestead, flourish each spring, a hopeful ghost garden reached only by a steep, strenuous journey for experienced hikers. And the picture shows the sunlight coming over the ridge and just a blanket of daffodils on the ground interspersed around the pine trees. Dorothea Dix Park in Raleigh. Thousands of daffodils delight in Flowers Field, unfurling a rolling ribbon of gold against our capital city skyline. The hardy bulbs were planted in 2018 and add springtime wonder to an urban park also lauded for its summertime sunflower displays. Raleigh Parks Recreation and Cultural Resources commissioned a bulb planting machine designed in the Netherlands to make less than a half day's work out of the Dix Park field. The North Carolina Arboretum. Long before leaves return, daffodils claim their space along fields, hills, and trails. The North Carolina Arboretum, just south of Asheville, within Pisgah National Forest, welcomes these early bloomers and is a telltale sign of the azaleas, galax, and trillium to come to the botanically diverse southern Appalachian mountains. The Paul J. Sinier Botanical Garden. 5 acres of themed gardens, including a formal boxwood-bordered pattern garden, await in Kernersville, where one of the Piedmont's largest displays of spring flowers is a seasonal draw. The next article is Best Buds. In this Wayne County town, residents don yellow and green to celebrate the bloom that put them on the map. By the time the 37th Annual Daffodil Festival rolls around in late March, Fremont's peak daffodil season has passed, but attendees wouldn't notice. On this spring day, the town is decked out in its daffodil best. Yellow-petaled wreaths adorn front doors, floral flags wave from porches, and daffodil sculptures stand proudly in the park. Bright bits of yellow bob throughout the crowd that fills the daffodil town on festival day. A mix of official festival t-shirts and faux daffodils dot ladies' hats and babies' headbands. Day trippers, locals, and natives are in attendance, all lured out of winter hibernation by the promise of old friends, funnel cakes, and skies just clear enough to inflict the first sunburn of the year. It just gives everybody a chance to get away from home for a little while, says town historian John Pippin. For him, a Fremont native, the crowd milling around downtown echoes his home's glorious days. Born a railway town called Nahunta in 1867, Fremont didn't earn its floral laurels until nearly a century later. The local tobacco industry reached its height in the early 1900s when Fremont boasted a movie theater, a tobacco factory, three car dealerships, and a downtown filled with shops, and one governor, Charles B. Acock, as their native son. In 1955, Fremont received its moniker from on high, the News and Observer, to highlight the local garden club's beautification efforts. According to the article, it started as with two bushels of daffodil bulbs, turned into a town-wide trend, with a daffodil bed in nearly every yard. By the mid-1950s, Fremont hosted an annual flower exhibit that showcased the town's daffodil varieties. Yet the exact date was always uncertain due to unpredictable North Carolina springs and daffodils' propensity to charge out of the earth at the first sign of warmth. Fremonters seized their title with gusto, adding daffodils to town signage and adopting bright yellow and forest green as their preferred colors for yearbooks, varsity jackets, and the water tower. But Fremont did not escape the familiar boom and bust cycle that hit many railroad towns in eastern North Carolina. The tobacco factory eventually ground to a halt. Local shops shuttered in favor of big box stores, and Fremont's children and grandchildren moved further afield in search of opportunity. Amid these changes, the daffodils remained. In the late 1980s, Fremont held its first daffodil festival. It estimates that the first event had a few hundred attendees. For the organizers, it was a labor of love executed by patchwork of locals. In the early years, the organizers enlisted local elementary school classes to make daffodil crafts to brighten vacant windows. Today, with the addition of new housing developments for people who do business in Smithfield, Wilson, and other nearby towns, Fremont's population is beginning to grow again. Last year, the 37th Annual Daffodil Festival welcomed 20,000 attendees and more than 100 vendors who sold food and daffodil-themed wares. Paul says the event shows off Fremont to newcomers, but also gives former Fremonters a reason to return and celebrate with the community. Thanks to Fremont's dedicated volunteers, the floral sculptures in the park and town pride, Daffodil Town is always in bloom. We've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. If you have questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.